This podcast of The Exchange is supported by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucettesurvey.com. That's D-O-U-C-E-T survey.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. When we think of rights in this country, we might think of free speech or the right to remain silent. And now in Europe, there's a new right, the right to be digitally forgotten. It addresses the seeming immortality of a negative article or embarrassing photo that makes its way onto the internet and is stored there forever for all to see. In May, Europe's highest court ruled that people can ask search engines to remove some links about them. And since then, Google has received tens of thousands of requests. The company is grappling with how to comply, complaining that the test for determining which results should be removed is, in its words, vague and subjective. Meanwhile, web watchers in the U.S. are wondering whether Americans will start clamoring for a similar law in the interest of personal privacy. But there's also a strong inclination here to keep information publicly available, whether it's a silly photo or a court document. Today in The Exchange, the right to be forgotten. Let's hear from you. Do you think this concept should take hold in the U.S. or not? How do we balance issues of privacy versus the public's right to know? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests with us from Miami. John David, president of the media relations firm David PR Group, whose clients include law firms and tech startups. He's also partner with the online reputation management firm WebFactCheck.com. John David, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us from New York, David Ewald. He's a journalist covering technology. He writes a blog for Forbes magazine. He's author of the award-winning book of Dice and Men, the story of Dungeons and Dragons and the people who play it. And David, great to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Hey, it's great to be here.
And also with us from D.C., Nuala O'Connor, president and CEO at the Center for Democracy and Technology. And Nuala, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Well, Nuala, I want to start with you, but hear from everybody. Just real basics, if we could, first. What's this about, Nuala? Is this about entirely erasing information or just making it harder to find?
Thanks so much. So we are concerned about this case involving a Spanish citizen who asked to have his Google search results erased, essentially. He had had a bankruptcy and some other negative financial things occur a few years back and said that because they were a little bit old, that they were no longer relevant, and that Google in particular had to no longer return that information in the search results. This is under the what's called the European Data Protection Directive, as enacted in Spain, which is the omnibus privacy law that exists all over Europe. We have different kinds of laws here in the United States, obviously, and I come at this as a former chief privacy officer of several companies. I believe strongly in one's right to be left alone and to have privacy in one's daily life, but even I am concerned about the impact on society. And we here in the United States, I think, would probably take a very different view and balance the right to know about your government, to know about yourself, to have accurate information online, and to have complete information online. And we're very concerned about the burden this places on Google and other search engines to be the ones to decide what gets left up and what gets pulled down.
Well, and who decides and what and so forth. So this is how it all got started, this story, Nuala. There was a gentleman in Spain who had had some financial difficulties, and he thought, hey, this happened a long time ago. I shouldn't have this dogging me.
That's exactly right. And, you know, we do have a right to be forgotten in the United States, and we've thought about this issue. And, you know, generally in the global dialogue, we're thought as a country to be less sophisticated on privacy. And I will take issue with that. I will say that we look at it as a sectoral issue. We have a financial right to be forgotten under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. I'm a big privacy wonk, as you can see, and I'm also originally trained as a banking lawyer. So we as a country have decided that when things get out of date, at some point you are forgiven. You have the right to be forgiven your past sins. But it's not that the data necessarily goes away. We are also a country of reinvention, of Madonna, of F. Scott Fitzgerald. We believe in one's right to be forgiven and to move on and to try something new. We even forgive our felons and say, you've served your time, you're allowed to go on and live a meaningful life. But we don't necessarily require that everybody forget. And what we're concerned about at the Center for Democracy and Technology is not just the impact on the individual and knowing a complete kind of history of a person you're doing business with or you're engaging with on socially or whatever, but the right of the press to have full and complete stories online, especially when the information is accurate and true. You know, I agree under the Fair Credit Reporting Act and a number of other laws, you have the right already to challenge information that's inaccurate. And we're very concerned also socially about issues of revenge porn and other issues of people putting stuff up that's damaging socially or emotionally. But we also fundamentally believe that there is a right to free speech, a right to complete information, a right to know in this country.
Well, yeah, and it's a big, big debate. And John David, you wrote in the Huff Post that it boils down to this question, who and what deserves to be forgotten? That's a big judgment call, isn't it, John?
Absolutely, it's something that I think that Google itself is grappling with in the EU about how they're going to handle this, and it comes down to this question. And I'm not an attorney, and I'm not a privacy lawyer, but I mean I deal with people all the time who have things written about them online that they don't like. And they want to see them, you know, they want to see these posts be gone. And the question becomes, you know, what is a lot of times things are posted online that aren't true. You know, that they're not written by a reporter at, you know, Reuters or a journalist who's employed by, you know, by Fox or MSNBC. They're you know, written by an estranged individual or something. And you know, I believe that in certain situations, you have a right to have that stuff disappear, and you don't. There is no mechanism for it right now. So that's an interesting point. And the other one is what falls into this? You know, if someone does something, you know, commits a horrific crime, is that, you know, perhaps that shouldn't be forgotten, right? And that makes perfect sense. But if you have an indiscretion as a teenager, you know, should that be forgotten? Just as if you have just as your juvenile crime record gets, you know, disappears after you turn 21. You know, if you do something foolish that ends up in the local paper when you're 19, you know, do you have a right to have that disappear when you're 45 and, you know, applying for, you know, the biggest job of your life?
Yeah. So how much does this stem from frustration, John, over false information posted somewhere on the internet? Nuala told us about the guy who kind of got this started in Spain, frustrated by this old negative information that he felt was dogging his career. But how much is this about just stuff that's plain not true?
Well, I think that that's what resonates with folks in the United States. People ask me all the time. I've asked me in the past couple months, you know, what's the difference between how is it possible that, you know, could this come to the United States? And the big difference, of course, is the First Amendment. So most things that get posted online kind of stay online unless they're defamatory or they are, unless they're, you know, they're illegal or there's some way there's some issue with national security. But, you know, you can kind of go and start a blog tomorrow and start writing, you know, nasty things about New Hampshire Public Radio. And there's very little that New Hampshire Public Radio can do about it. And sometimes people write defamatory things and there's no means to, there's no means to get them, you know, removed from search. And it's a very frustrating problem that happens to a lot of folks.
Wow, David Ewalt.
So I can
see
where it would come from.
Love your take on this too, David Ewalt. Your take on this whole debate, you know, privacy versus right to know, and so forth.
Well, I think there's two very important issues here. One is what we're already in talking about, which is whether we deserve and or want to have old information about us forgotten. I think most people would agree, yes, we'd like to be able to have privacy and have these things forgotten. Where we run into trouble is with the second part of this issue, which is it possible to have this information forgotten or lost or have the kind of privacy that we'd like in the age of the internet? And I think the way that these technologies are playing out are making it increasingly difficult for us to get what we want. I mean, we can say, all right, well, Google can take down these search results. Well, you know, the server, the places where the files are actually being served up is still going to be there. We can say we'd like our kids' photos to be forgotten. You know, maybe we can even convince Facebook to take them down when the kids turn 18. But what happens if they get copied to another site? So this is a much more complicated issue than just, you know, sort of the politics of, well, should we have privacy and should things be forgotten? We've sort of built ourselves into this. You know, depending on whether you're a fan of it or not, you could describe it as sort of we built this kind of, you know, technological jail around us, or, you know, panopticon. People can see us and can see our history because of the system that we've built around ourselves. And if we want to keep using the system, well, we're going to have to continue giving up a lot of these things that we might like to have, like privacy.
So, David, are you saying, you know, never mind questions of, you know, right to know or whatever, you're questioning whether they can even really do this because there's just so much out there. And sure, there's Google, but there's other search engines too.
Sure. I mean, on a very fundamental level, we start to look at this. Okay, well, the EU is telling Google, if there's something about me that's in the past, you know, maybe I had some financial problems, maybe I had an arrest for something trivial a long time ago, you know, a person in Europe should have the right to say to Google, hey, remove that from the search results. If somebody Googles my name, they shouldn't be able to find out that I filed for bankruptcy 30 years ago. And they have a very legitimate argument there. The problem comes in, all right, well, maybe Google removes that from their search results in Europe. Well, if somebody searches for that person in the United States, they're still going to find that information because Google hasn't removed it from its other services, just in the EU. Or maybe someone searches on Bing, or someone searches on Ask Jeeves, or someone searches on some search
right.
engine that hasn't even invented yet, that hasn't taken the information down. You run into that first wall there of just like, well, can we get every single search engine and take it down? And
so,
then the bigger problem
yeah.
is search engines just point. Even if you take down the search results, the information is still out there. So now I have to go hunting down the individual site operators and get them to take it off their site. Just really, it's kind of technologically infeasible to really forget stuff on the internet.
Well, it almost makes me wonder, David, you know, why they're bothering. It sounds like they can't really do this.
Well, they can to the extent that Google is a very dominant search engine. So if there's a high ranking, if you Google my name and there's a high ranking thing I don't like, I mean, look at what I just said, actually. I just said, if you Google my name.
Yeah,
Google's
it's a verb.
Google's so prominent, it's become a verb. So it really does mean something to take something off of Google. But it's not going to actually disappear that information. It's just going to make it harder to find. Maybe
right.
for some people that's okay, is that, well, now it's not everybody knows that this thing happened in my past because, you know, they have to dig for it. But those who want to dig will still find.
Coming up, we'll talk more with our guests. We'll take your calls as well, and we'll look at the idea of cultural differences between Europe and the U.S. when it comes to feelings about privacy and the right to know. All that, plus your questions and comments. So keep it right here on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the right to be forgotten. A new rule in the European Union aims to remove access to certain material online if users request it. Join us 1-800-892-6477. Do you think this concept should take hold in the U.S. or not? How do we balance issues of privacy versus the public's right to know? What sorts of information should be easily removed and what should stay out there? Again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook at NHPR Exchange, all one word. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So all of you, let's talk a little bit more about Google and, you know, how really the focus has been on that one company. John, David, what do you think? Is that misguided to just focus on Google? Are there other companies that are involved in this?
That's actually a really good point, and I thought David made a very interesting point, and we put a huge onus on Google. They own search in the U.S. and largely around the world, I guess. And you're making a private company make all these decisions, and it does seem a bit untenable, you know. But they are the market leader, and the reality is, if you look at most people who track their, you know, their website traffic, they'll tell you that. For their, you know, organic search that comes through search engines, you know, it's 95% of it, you know, comes from Google. And even, you know, Bing is backed by, you know, Microsoft, and there's other you'd assume that there'd be other room for other search engines. Google continues to dominate, and should this also filter to other search engines, and will they be able to comply? Has this become another regulatory layer that hinders the commerce of search engines? It's an interesting question.
Yeah, about who decides. So let's say I had a DWI when I was 19, Nuala, okay, and I'm, let's just say 45 now. I send Google a request. I say, hey, I think this is irrelevant and I don't like people knowing this about me. And Google decides, some person at Mountain View, California, where the headquarters are, says, no, Laura, I think that's important for everyone to know. I mean, so I lose. I mean, it just seems so random and subjective. Who decides what information should be kept up and what shouldn't, Nuala?
So I think you've raised a number of good points in that question. First is, all of these records are public, right? With the exception, as was pointed out before, if you're a minor, some things are expunged when you reach 18. So if you're 19, you're an adult. Now, it may seem overly, you might feel exposed because that's now online or easily searchable. And I think that's the societal issue we're getting to. All of these records were already public records in the United States, your arrest records, your property records, where you live. But the idea that they're so easily searchable and easily kind of accessible is a larger societal question. How long do we want everyone to remember everything online?
Right.
However, the first 50, half a dozen people to make requests of the Google search new kind of apparatus in Europe were prominent members of UK politician who'd had some kind of financial scandal involving government funds and misuse of government funds. He now wants to have that information erased, and we will not be able to. Ordinary voters doing a Google search on that person in a future election will not be able to know that this is a person who had a fraud kind of arrest or incident involving government activity in the past. That's a problem. Now, you're a private citizen. You might make the argument that I really feel badly about that thing that happened when I was 19, but it was an actual arrest and conviction, and I did, go to jail or whatever. That's problematic, and we probably need to have a conversation as a country about how long we want to remember and when we want to forget. But on the whole, I would still tilt heavily towards having a complete understanding of the individual, complete understanding of what their past deeds have been in making decisions about, whether I want to elect them to a government post or whether I want them teaching my children, whether I want them being my kid's babysitter. So I don't want people to be able to self-selectively delete accurate and true information. Now, if it's inaccurate, we have laws, libel and slander, and many reputable companies like Google already engage in notice and takedown procedures for inaccurate or fraudulent goods or that sort of thing. I don't want accurate and true information, however harmful it may be. I'd rather live in a country that says, we know you did a bad thing, fill in the name of your favorite ex-president. However, we're still going to vote for you because we believe you can lead the country effectively, rather than I'm just going to delete all of this stuff and want to have a sanitized version of myself online.
Let's go to our listeners and then a lot more questions for all of you. The exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, John's calling in from Ringe. Hi, John. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm a state representative, and we actually had legislation relating to just this type of issue. It was a woman from Derry who, I guess she left her dogs in the car, and she was eventually found not guilty, but we had legislation to put in which to allow her to request the newspapers to take down those articles that were written about her. Mainly because not so much about the articles themselves, but that all the comments that were coming in after and people really saying the very mean and nasty things about her and probably fairly inappropriate too. But the bill died mainly because we couldn't see how you really could enforce it. And the fact is the newspaper didn't do anything wrong. It's just the comments. And we actually took note that Wall Street Journal stopped doing comments just for that reason.
The comment section. So just back up a little bit, if you could, John, and thanks for calling in. It's interesting to hear that New Hampshire's legislature has been looking at this. So this woman left her dogs in the car. There was an article about it. The dogs presumably suffered, died as a result of being left in a hot
car? No harm came to the dogs.
What's that?
No harm came to the
dogs. No harm came to the dogs. Okay. But this still got publicized as a negligent pet owner act.
Exactly.
So a local newspaper wrote an article about it, and then this woman was subjected to all sorts of nastiness as a result and finally wanted it to stop.
Right. And so the legislation that if we were to pass it, would have said, would have given her the right to request these newspapers to take down the news story and therefore then to take down those comments that went with it.
So how did you feel about this as a state lawmaker?
I myself personally as a legislator, I'm very conscious of unenforceable laws and laws that are really are more feel good than really are effective. And the reality is that there's not much you can do about it. The newspaper wrote it. The story was there. And I don't know that it's how much permanent damage to her reputation, but she did feel damaged. So she felt compelled to get a representative from Derry to put the bill in. But at the end of the day, we did not pass the bill.
Wow, real interesting. Thank you, John, for calling in. John David, what about this, the idea, and we explored this a little bit earlier, too, that in the end, this isn't really enforceable.
That's a really good point. But one thing the first thing I thought about with that example, which is an excellent example, because let's just say this is this is someone who's not famous for anything, right? Let's has a low profile, a low online profile, and then all of a sudden a newspaper writes a story, and that includes this person's name. Well, when it comes to search results, the newspaper is going to have this very high level of authority with the search engine, and so that's likely when you Google the lady's name with the dogs, that's the first thing that's going to come up. And then if you go back and you realize that the story might be, now newspapers are, they have no obligation to follow this story, right? They write the story, woman gets arrested or cited or whatever for leaving her dogs in the car on a hot summer day, and then the 2 weeks later she might be found not guilty, but the newspaper reporter might be, covering something completely different that day. And they may not write an equally weighted story in the newspaper about what happened to this woman. So everyone, when anyone Googles her, they find out that they see that, they think that she's
animal abuser.
She's an animal abuser, right. So this is really sort of at the heart of what happens. Because right now what you're stuck with as your option is to do the other means of trying to have that either removed or have that, that search result pushed down in some way, or to try to, make an overture to a newspaper to, remove remove that story, which it's not going to happen. So those are the type of examples and there's millions of them, and I hear them all the time. People get things written about them that just have this little quirkiness to it, and they end up very high on search, and that's your reputation right now, is how you're Googled.
Could I just jump
sure,
in
go
that?
Ahead, Nuala, and then back to our listeners. Yeah,
such a great example. And as a dog owner and a dog lover and a mom, I'm concerned about all of these issues personally. But you raised two good points. One is, much is said about the demise of journalism online and how people blog and put all sorts of stuff up, and it's not true. I mean, I do believe in the marketplace of ideas. I do believe that countering bad speech and hate speech with more speech and accurate speech and good speech will help. But I've also seen the incident of incorrect, by good journalism, incorrect facts that are then able to be corrected right there in the article online, which is very different than a paper newspaper, which, of course, is read and thrown in the trash, and then there's a little retraction or correction a couple of days later in the bottom of the editorial page. This can actually be in real time on the same page in the same place, and I've seen those kind of corrections, and that's very, I think, helpful to correcting inaccurate speech. But you raised the larger question of comments, and I think that is just such a fascinating and really difficult issue. The level of discourse online, I was at a speech by the author Brené Brown the other day, and she said she stopped reading comments and that she thinks that it reveals some of the worst of humanity, because people feel unfettered when they are anonymous. I mean, so it raises the larger question of identity versus anonymity online and what people want to do about that. People seem to feel unfettered in the vitriol they're able to spew in comment sections to newspaper articles and the like because they are not identified, and there's no kind of accountability for those kinds of comments. And so this is one of the bigger societal questions that may not be able to be regulated, but we should really be having a conversation about as a society with ourselves, our families, our children. It's something we're exploring called the digital self. What is our self-expression and our self-identity online? Are there online civics that we need to be teaching our children, not only for their safety and security, but for their civility? And the point was made, and it's right, that a number of newspapers are taking down the comment sections entirely because they feel they're just unproductive. Facebook's policy, as we all know, is that you have to have a real identity. Now, people do skirt that with changing their last names or using initials or whatever, but you are required to have a unique and hopefully identifiable to in the real world identity.
So it gets to this other issue about people presenting themselves differently online, maybe getting a little bit nastier online, and that's feeding some of this desire for other people to just say, get me off. I don't want anything to do with it. That seems to be what you're saying there, Nuala.
Well, it's a concern, and we don't want to say to people you should have to opt out of digital life in order to be safe or to feel like you have some kind of recourse or redress for inaccurate or hateful speech online.
Okay.
But I don't think the solution is to require Google to do all the work to clean it all up.
Well, John, thank you again for calling in, and let's take Jack in Hanover. Hi, Jack. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. I think the Europeans have it right. I have this situation where a family member was going to work. The family member had ADD medication with her, just enough to cover her during her hours of work. She also had a marijuana cigarette. She was stopped, and subsequently she was booked. And the booking was for an uncontrolled substance, the ADD medication, and the marijuana cigarette. Now, subsequently, it came out that that her doctor was called. Yes, she had a prescription for the ADD medication, but what a parasite service did was they put her arrest online, and it included both factors, both the marijuana cigarette and the ADD medication. So now if you Google her, her mugshot comes up. The alleged arrest was for these two substances, even though one was very legal. She had a prescription for it, and it cost $400 to take that site down.
Wow. So imagine that this person is applying for a job, Jack, and the employer has a nice interview, and he says, oh, she seems great, and he calls her references, she seems terrific, and then he does a little Google search, and he sees a mugshot. So he's
exactly.
He or she isn't really going to
exactly. And this whoever owns the service that has put this mugshot up has done it. You can go through pages and pages, and they have these mugshots of people, and sure, their arrest record is there, but the subsequent how it was judged in court is not there, and so there should be some sort of safety guard to guard against services like this, who are only in it for one reason, and that's to embarrass somebody so badly that they're willing to pay the money to make it go away.
Wow.
This should not be protected under our First Amendment rights.
Jack's real interesting story. David Ewalt, what do you think?
Well, it's a really interesting case because that's clearly someone who is, I like that you describe the site as parasitic, because that's someone who is looking for these loopholes in the law and in the technology and finding a way to exploit them and exploit people. And that gets, maybe that's a place where it's easier to address, because maybe we can change the laws and say, we do want mugshots to be public record, but you can't use them elsewhere for profit. Maybe there are sort of ways that we can fix that sort of hole. But at some level, you're still looking at a case where if someone gets arrested, maybe we can stop the guy from posting the mugshot and selling the chance to take it down, but we can't stop, maybe that person's friend writes on their blog, oh my God, my friend so-and-so just got arrested. She had pot in her car and she had ADD pills and the cops busted her. She's in so much trouble. Well, are we going to be able to go and say, well, you have to take that blog post down where you wrote about your friend getting busted? Because without context, it looks really bad for her. It's really complicated, obviously, of like
sure.
How we get people to take care of that. I think if there is a solution, part of the solution might be just time. I think part of the issue is that we look at people, you know, you Google someone's name, you maybe find this one bad thing. You're like, oh my God, they were arrested. Maybe with more time and more of us spend more of it on the internet and we get used to it, people will take that less seriously. Maybe they'll understand, oh, well, this is just one site. Maybe I need to look elsewhere. Because it's not, I mean, like I say, it's not so easy to make that information go away. I think maybe the solution is in educating the people who use the internet to understand, don't believe everything you read.
So
there's more to this story.
There's so much out there, David, that it'll all be a wash at some point.
At some point, I mean, think about this. So we've, you know, most adults have only been using the internet for a decade, maybe two decades, you know, have been using it really sincerely. And for us, it's a brand new experience. You know, if you've been using it for a quarter or a fifth of your life or something like that, it's not that long. But if you're a kid, you were born in 2000, you've grown up with the internet. Everything you've ever done is probably on the internet. Your friends are taking pictures and putting them on Facebook. You're writing blogs. Your friends are writing blogs. Things you do are getting written about in school newspapers that go on the internet. So in another 10, 20, 30 years, a kid who was born in the year 2000, there's going to be a huge amount of information on the internet. Some of it good, some of it bad. But the hope here is that because there's so much information about them, it might sort of flush out some of the little negative things. They'll be harder to find just because there's just a flood of information, and the negatives will be smoothed out.
Just going into a break real quickly, but John David, what do you think? At some point, there's so much that, you know, one or two mugshots won't matter.
There's it's a very interesting point that David makes, but the chink in the armor is the concept of authority when it comes to websites. So Google has given these parasitic, I love that, parasitic websites, which I think are absolutely abhorrent. I mean, they make me crazy. They've given them a lot of authority because they get a lot of traffic. And the same thing happens with stories that get a lot of comments. When I write my blog, my blog stays up longer on Huffington Post if a lot of people are commenting on it. Now there's some people comment and, you know, dislike what I write. Some people like what I write. But the reality is, if more people comment on it, it stays up longer. So there's a.
Your editors like that. Yeah. Let me jump in on you for just a moment there, if I could. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, more conversation, more of your calls, comments, and so forth. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we spend the hour with Dartmouth's president, Philip Hanlon. We'll spend the hour talking with him about some of the challenges and changes at the college over his first year. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Today in The Exchange, the new European Union rule about a digital right to be forgotten, whether certain information can be taken off of a basic Google search or not. Join us 1-800-892-6477. Do you think that America should go this direction with a right to be forgotten? How do we balance issues of privacy versus public right to know? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guests are Nuala O'Connor, David Ewalt, and John David. And all of you, let's go back to our listeners. Doug's waiting in Wilton. Hi, Doug. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Thank you. Let me explain. I had an occasion where I learned something about French law versus American law. If someone submits their information to a company, then it's all right for the company to use that information for that explicit purpose. But for them to take it and sell it, send it on to another division in another country for that country's use in another purpose, not legal. And it's very simple. It's your name and address. It belongs to you. And
so that's a French law, Doug.
That's a French law,
yeah.
Right.
So more attention to individual privacy in France, is that what you're saying?
Well, exactly. Oh, you can't believe how much more. But here we have the rule that, you know, it's a Wild West, and you don't own anything of yours, including your own genome. Someone else can patent it. So we might want to change the way we look at the fundamentals in this country as opposed to a specific issue like Google.
You know, this is real interesting. Yeah, Doug, thank you for calling. This is something I wanted to ask you all about. Nuala, I'll go to you first. What sorts of cultural differences do you see existing between Europe and the U.S. when it comes to this idea of privacy?
So much is made of the differences across the Atlantic between the European laws, which are all somewhat similar. They all derive from the European Data Protection Directive. So the French law is slightly different in how it plays out to the Spanish law, but they are all roughly the same. And all of these laws emanate, including our what privacy laws we have in the United States, emanate from the Fair Information Principles and some U.S.-EU dialogue in the OECD Principles, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, from the early 1970s. They really stem from a time when mainframe computers were a new thing, government data collection was ubiquitous and growing, and people were scared. They really come out of a kind of post-Watergate era in the United States. And the fundamental underpinnings of one's right to be left alone, one's right of kind of self-determination are actually quite similar, not only culturally but legally. How the laws play out are very different. And in Europe, there are strong regulators. They are called data protection authorities. They are federal regulators that are charged with simply protecting personal privacy and data of an individual versus companies. In the United States, we actually have stronger laws that protect your privacy, ironically, and given our recent Snowden and NSA issues, in its use by federal government agencies, and less kind of omnibus or overarching laws in the United States about corporate privacy. However, having worked in privacy now for over 20 years, the laws are marching forward, and I think in some ways I'm hoping that there'll be more accord between kind of Europe and the U.S., where we all learn a little bit from each other. In the U.S., we have the Federal Trade Commission, which has been a very strong enforcer and a very effective enforcer of personal privacy and misuse and really harms and inappropriate use. I'm very sympathetic to the last caller, and I think it raises a very important issue about the parasites, about the Wild West nature of the internet and where we are right now
so
in its
Nuala,
evolution.
Sorry to interrupt. Just clear up for me, though. I'm still not clear on how you see people in the U.S. versus people in Europe feeling about privacy. Are you saying that Europeans are more concerned about privacy than Americans are?
No, I would think you'd actually be surprised. In dealing and having been at companies that do business in Europe and having been born in Europe, I think that we are much more similar than we are different on these issues. We want to know that when we give our data to a company, it's for a legitimate use. When I buy a CD or a book online, I want to get that CD or book delivered to my house, so I have to give you my name and address. I don't want to suddenly receive marketing materials from 18 other companies. That's absolutely right. And I think we've had good enforcement in this country, again, by the Federal Trade Commission, by the state's attorneys general, and by class action attorneys that really prevent the kind of overbroad and misuse. There was the famous example of the flashlight app that the FTC just enforced against. The flashlight app, when you downloaded it to your smartphone, was taking your contacts and a whole bunch of other data off your phone for its own use. I don't know why a flashlight app would need to know all my personal contacts in order to turn the light on my phone, right? So I get the idea of misuse and kind of excessive use. That's absolutely a fair point. But we don't see really strong differences in Europe in terms of wanting to do business, wanting to be online. There's a huge Facebook contingent. There's a huge Google user base in Europe. So I think that we are actually more similar than we are different.
So why the difference then, John David, in terms of this new European rule versus the fact that we don't have anything like that in this country? If we feel the same way as the Europeans do, you know, we don't want people messing with our personal information. Why is there the fact that Europe has this new rule and we don't?
Well, I mean, I think it's the difference is, you know, our laws versus their laws, and I think the other big point is that, you know, if Google had decided that they were, you know, okay with this ruling, then they might, you know, try to migrate it, you know, to the United States. I mean, there would be an uproar and lots of arguments going on, but Google has decided that they don't like this. And from a business perspective, you know, it's another layer of business.
Oh, sure, it's a pain in the neck for them.
Create a big department to do this and pull together this, you know, group of folks who are going to make these decisions and everything else. It's a massive cost for them. So I think that there's forces working against it, you know, to coming to the United States. You know, and the biggest one being, you know, being the First Amendment and how our laws are different than in the EU.
What do you think, David Ewalt?
Well, Well, I think that's all right. I think I could play devil's advocate too, and throw in a related issue, which is the caller was talking about how there are laws in France that prohibit companies from passing information from division to division and telling them what they can do with it. One wrinkle in this would be that by giving American companies the ability to take your personal information and to run away with it, whether it's your arrest record or whether it's your genome or stuff like that, and a lot of that is what allows these companies to come up with the new features that we like and to innovate and to create jobs. You can look at something as simple as, Apple starts using your voice, when you press your button on your phone to talk to Siri and ask it a question. Apple processes that information, and you get to find out where the nearest pizza place is. But Apple then uses that voice information to build a giant database of voice-to-text information, and that will lead to new products that allow a computer to really understand when you're talking to it. So we have to decide, do we want our privacy? Does it bother us so much that the computer is recording when we talk to it and sharing this information from division to division? Or do we want to have smarter, faster computers that you can talk to and that you can dictate to, and that'll be able to create new businesses and keep the economy going? Laws like the one the caller's talking about in France might keep Apple from doing that because they can't pass that data from a division to division. If anything, I guess the point of this is it's all very complicated,
yeah.
And there's a lot of knockdown effect.
That's
if
for sure.
If you say, okay, you can't share this information, it's more than just, all right, well, now people, have more privacy. You've also created some other effects like, now it's going to be harder for these other things to be built on top of it.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. Here's a question for you, Nuala, because I know you used to work at the Department of Homeland Security. How might the Right to Be Forgotten law in this country, if we had it, which we don't, but how would this conflict with the government's desire to, quote unquote, connect the dots when it comes to sniffing out terrorist groups? This was a huge criticism after 9/11 that the information was out there, but the authorities didn't connect the dots strongly enough, and we all know what happened. So if there is a right to be digitally forgotten, how is this task affected, Nuala?
Well, as one of the other speakers pointed out, this doesn't erase the data. It just erases it or deletes it from the search results provided to you when you put in a unique individual's name.
So it's still there.
The data would still be out there. I'm not that concerned about the efficacy of the NSA or the Department of Homeland Security being able to find that data. In fact, we've shown in the last year they're quite good at taking data, whether it's publicly available or not. And so I think, we'd be concerned about that from a totally different standpoint. We want to make sure that we're very aware of when the government is looking at our data online, and that the companies that do business online have good protections against the kind of wholesale importation of data into the federal government coffers. So I think that this decision, if folks are concerned about that, and they should be, this is not a decision that's going to be helpful there.
Well, and here's another question I wanted to ask. It stems from something you wrote, Nuala, and I want to ask, I think, David about it. Nuala wrote a piece, as she said this hour, really raising a lot of concerns about this right to be forgotten. And in it, she said the right to be forgotten creates a, quote, sanitized history, that this impulse toward revisionist history and use of internet censorship to achieve it is characteristic of authoritarian regimes. What do you think, David? We do hear about, history books in the Soviet era having pages ripped out because it didn't fit with the image that the Soviets were trying to put forward.
It's absolutely true. And for every story we hear about, my sister had prescription drugs and now people think she's a drug addict and we wish we could get rid of that story, there's going to be a story where somebody doesn't have a prescription and we need to know that they have a problem because a month later they apply for a job driving school buses. So it's very problematic anytime you want to revise the story on somebody, change the story. And the authoritarian angle comes in when you're asking a single body, when you're asking someone like Google to decide, should this be removed or not? I mean, remember in all these cases, there would be some guy, probably, to be honest, some like 23-year-old kid who was just pulled out of the Google internship program, who's sitting in a cubicle somewhere in Mountain View, California, who's reading this case and deciding, you know, this person can deal with it. Oh, okay, I sympathize with this person. We'll remove this search result. And that suddenly makes Google the arbiter of what's the truth and what's not.
It's very godlike, isn't it?
It's extremely godlike, and they already have a lot of power. I'm not sure I want to give them that one, too. So we have to decide whether we're more comfortable with, you know, the power being very dispersed out, sort of as it is right now, or handing it to someone who is maybe a benevolent or a malevolent god.
Well, so, John David, why do Europeans feel comfortable with that scenario that David paints, that, you know, a 23-year-old in Mountain View, California, is sitting there saying, you know, I do think it's relevant that Laura was arrested when she was 19. You know, let's keep that up there. Why do Europeans think that that's okay?
I mean,
so much
power? The jury's still out on this. I mean, the European court said it. I'm not sure if necessarily how the European people, feel about it.
Sure.
There's clearly some folks who are happy about this because they have things they want to see, disappear from search results. I think to sort of be the pro and con here. One thing is there's so much information out there online that is false and wrong, and that people have done to spite people, and it's malicious, and it's an incredible amount. I mean, it's almost you can talk to pretty much any professional person, and they'll have a story of someone who had something written about them online that they can't get, that they can't have removed, and they didn't commit a crime, they didn't do anything, they may have pissed someone off. And so, to me, there's a value in this. Of course, how do you judge it is why we're on the phone, why we're talking about it today. But I think there's a value for this, because we wouldn't be having this conversation. And I see it every day of people who want stuff taken down from search results, and it's a big deal.
Sure, and the caller who called earlier about the family member who had, a mugshot up there making her look all dangerous and scary when, in fact, it was a smaller infraction. So there's a value to doing this, John. The devil's in the details. How do you do it? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's really the core of the question, because I think that you can argue both sides. If you take out the marijuana cigarette part of this of the argument and the lady had a controlled substance, but she has a prescription for it, so and she still gets her mugshot up there. I mean, that's not fair. So that's the question: is what's fair, what's not fair, who gets to decide, who doesn't get to decide?
Right. So Newell, I'm getting a sense from you and the others that this probably won't fly in the U.S. What do you think?
I think it's unlikely, but as I said before, we do have we have specific industry sector laws, and the Fair Credit Reporting Act in finance, for example, does allow you to forgive and forget your bankruptcies and your past short sales and foreclosures and all the bad things that happened to so many people during the last recession. So we do have the ability to decide as a country what our norms are, and I think this is, as was pointed out earlier, this is really the challenge of our new digital community, our new digital environment. What are the norms that we're going to decide as a society are going to work for us about how long we retain information and how long it's really relevant? I do not think, we're hopeful that in more omnibus federal privacy laws that are kind of fair and transparent and allow for an even playing field for the consumers, are in the future. We would not advocate for deletion of accurate information or fair information, across the board.
Sure. David Ewalt, what do you think? Is this going to cross the pond or stay in Europe?
I think in the form we're seeing it in Europe, it's going to stay over there. I think there's as Newell says, there are solutions over here that also work. There are smaller solutions. There are government solutions, and there are also private solutions. You can hire a company to wipe your name off of Google. Things like that will be more predominant in the U.S. than as opposed to some big overarching, Google must do this law.
Yeah. John David, last thoughts from you.
Yeah, I think I largely agree. I don't, in its current form, I don't imagine that we would have that in the United States. But never say never. Some variant, some policy may come out of it that Google decides makes sense.
Okay.
Across its whole universe.
great to talk to all of you. John David, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's John David. He joined us from Miami. He's president of the media relations firm David PR Group. David Ewald, it was great to have you too. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
David Ewald, journalist covering technology. He writes a blog for Forbes, is author of the book of Dice and Men, the story of Dungeons and Dragons and the people who play it. And Nuala O'Connor, thank you also for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nuala O'Connor, president and CEO at the Center for Democracy and Technology. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Mikesell. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our interns are James Pouliot and Renee Taylor. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.